Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
One, two, tres, cuatro.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're doing a classic album dissection of Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy by Brian Eno. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. Let's jump right in.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
When I got back home, I found a message on the door. Sweet Regina's gone to China, cross-legged on the floor.
Greg, it must be said that it was not my insistence that we do this as a classic album. The producers all said, hey, you know, we mention Eno a lot. We've never done one of his records. Why not? And, you know, one answer to why not, Greg, is because it's hard to choose just one.
That's true.
I don't mean that as a slavering Eno superfan. There were four key albums that he dropped, generally called by fans the pop albums, between 1974 and 1977. He had broken with Roxy Music, you'll fill us in on that in a second, and released the first record, Here Come the Warm Jets, in 74. Later that same year, Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy, another Green World in 75, Before and After Science, 77. When the producer said, hey, why don't you boys do a classic album dissection on Eno? The question wasn't no or yes. It was like, well, which one? Because we could do all four, but then that would be a four-hour, you know, radio show. So we settled on Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. Give us the back. Who was Brian Peter George Paul Ringo Eno? The man with so many. No, it's Brian Peter George Eno.
Right. Born May 15th, 1948 in Suffolk. Good fair bit of distance outside of London. Went to art school. A couple of art schools. Of nice art schools in the mid-60s. Ipswich Civic College and then Winchester School of Art. Thought he was going to be a painter. Ended up falling in with Roxy Music in 1971, Brian Ferry, and he initially thought his role was going to be to record the band. He didn't think he was a musician at all.
Musicians
play in bands. Yeah. I'm not a musician. So
right.
What's my job? He had to sort of define the job, and I think that's one of the things that make Eno so alluring and so powerful a figure for subsequent generations of people who make music, is what he brought to the table without technically being a trained musician. He soon carved out a new role as an artist who painted with sound using reel-to-reel tape recorders and that VCS3 synthesizer.
Yes.
Big part of those first two Roxy Music records, which changed the world. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that. The self-titled record in 1972, the 1973 record For Your Pleasure, mapping out a new frontier. I mean, think about it. The Stones and Led Zeppelin are defining what rock and roll is during this era, and along comes this band, Roxy Music, which
right.
is just upending everything. Eno himself, very proud of these records. The debut album alone, he said, contained about 12 different futures.
Yeah, it's true.
He was only slightly exaggerating. It's kind of like that first Velvet Underground record for the next generation of artists.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's concurrent with the glam era, but really also laying the groundwork for punk and new wave and art rock. Taking, you know, progressive in that era means, you know, Yes and Genesis, but this is a progression in other directions with Roxy Music. You know, it has to be said that Eno, behind the synthesizers, behind the reel-to-reels, with ostrich feathers flaring and, you know, eyeshadow, Brian Ferry has an ego, so does Brian Eno. And it was inevitable, almost, that Eno would have to go, because so much of the attention was going to Eno. I found this radio interview, Greg, late at night on a Detroit radio station, 1974. So here come the Warm Jets. Eno's solo debut has already come out, and he's talking about the new album. But first, he talks about why he split with Roxy. Mm-hmm. As he says, there's a scandalous reason and the professional reason.
When did you leave Roxy Music?
Exactly a year today.
Really?
Funnily enough, yeah. It was July the 21st, isn't it?
Could I ask you, would it be imposing upon you to ask you why?
Well, there are a number of reasons. Which one do you want? The scandalous ones?
Definitely.
The professional ones? The musical ones?
Scandalous, disgusting ones, for sure. Definitely.
Reason one, the scandalous reason.
Oh, good.
A certain undercurrent of jealousy that seemed to be rampant in the group at the time between certain members. Number two, the professional reason. I was getting quite bored with touring practically all my life. I mean, we spent, I think, 8.5 months of the last year that I was in Roxy on tour, which I don't enjoy doing that much. I mean, a frail lad like myself, it's not at all good for my complexion, you know. I still work with some of the members of Roxy quite extensively. Like, in a month's time, I'm recording with Phil and Paul from Roxy. And I'll use them throughout the whole album, you know. It won't be just like guest musicians, they'll be there all the time.
It's going to be Eno, Phil and Paul, is that how it will be billed, or?
No, it won't.
They're not going to get the top billing, right?
No, well, what happens is that they won't be the only people on the album. There'll also be Fripp, who should be there quite a lot, I think. Brian Turrington, who's the bass player of the Winkees, a group that you wouldn't know in Canada or America, or England, actually. They're not very well known at all. And then various other friends. Robert Wyatt will be on it as well, and your Soft Machine. Yeah.
When is this going to come about?
Well, I start when I get back from the States, which is on August the 5th. I start rehearsing for it then, and I start recording middle of August or something like that.
So there's a little Brian Eno. He, you know, he's on the in Detroit, so on the border with Canada. He seems to think he's in Canada.
Right.
I just love that. Here come the Warm Jets, kids out there. Here's what it's akin to. When Nirvana ended because Kurt Cobain died, and suddenly we have this record by something called Foo Fighters, it was like, what a surprise. Dave Grohl can write songs, sing, make a record. That's sort of what it was like when Brian Eno released Here Come the Warm Jets, because all of his interviews, he had talked so much about being a non-musician.
Oh,
Now, he has subsequently walked that back. He could play certain melodies. Mm-hmm. He wasn't a virtuoso, not like Phil Manzanera or Andy Mackay and, you know, his bandmates on guitar and woodwinds in Roxy Music. But he did have some knowledge, and he had imagination, and he had friends, right?
And he was also a singer.
He had background in choir. Very good singer, mm-hmm. who had grown up listening to doo-wop and had a deep-seated love of that American harmony music. So, you know, Here Come the Warm Jets comes out in 74, and he has 16 different musicians, some of them big names on the British scene at the moment, contributing to it. Everyone is surprised. Maybe it's just a one-off. Can he repeat himself? Can he do anything else? This is when he gears up to make Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. He's talked about it in that interview. He's going to rely heavily on Manzanera. A lot of people coming and going on the first album. He forms a core band on this album. Manzanera on guitar, you know, really key. He taps the rhythm section from a group called the Winkees, you know, which nobody has heard of since and nobody had heard of then. But an excellent bass player, good drummer, and his pal, Robert Wyatt. Tell us about Mr. Wyatt.
Well, Wyatt was the drummer in that progressive rock band Soft Machine, a very essential progressive art rock band in the 60s. And then he got kicked out of the band, excessive drinking.
Well, he fell out a window.
Well, and then he paralyzed himself, from the waist down after falling out of a fourth floor apartment window because apparently he was loaded. Yeah. I've interviewed him. He was very open about it. It was a dumb thing to do. Yeah. It cost him his career as a drummer. But he went on to make numerous solo records as a vocalist and songwriter and a percussionist, which he does on this Eno record. And we've got cameos here from Phil Collins of Genesis.
Yeah.
Because Eno had helped out quite a bit on The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, and Peter Gabriel says, "What can we do in return for you, Brian?" You know? And
Eno
says, "I want Collins."
Yeah.
Give me Collins. And he plays on the record, one of the tracks.
Must be noted, Eno credited with Enosification.
Yes.
On the Lamb Lies Down.
Right. Whatever that was,
well, he
added
it. Well, he ran through the reel-to-reels and the synthesizer.
But, you know, and then Andy McKay, also of Roxy, adding some brass on the Fat Lady of Limburg. But then, you know, the wild card here is the Portsmouth Sinfonia.
Yeah.
An orchestra in which Eno had played some clarinet. And again, this orchestra was all about, if you can't play that instrument, go ahead. You're welcome.
Right.
Or if you don't have any training at all, you're welcome. We don't want trained musicians playing the instrument that they are trained on.
And if you are an instrumentalist who knows oboe, we're going to put you instead on timpani.
Right. So the whole idea was to completely change your way of approaching music. Again, a very key idea, I think, in the Eno universe is this idea of, you know, don't let your training hold you back from a great idea. In fact, open it up and say, what can I do to completely defeat all that training to do something brand new that I haven't experienced before? Maybe go out on the limb a little bit, feeling a little shaky, a little nervous about this, but try that instead of what you already know.
I've said this before, Eno is a philosopher, And that is his biggest contribution to the history of rock and roll and popular music over the last half century plus. He goes into these projects trying to forward an agenda. And that sounds pedagogical, but it's not. Number one, first and foremost, was the recording studio in and of itself is an instrument. We can do amazing things that couldn't be done, no matter how great the musicians playing together in a room, live or in rehearsal. We can use this technology to create music. Number two, that we have to be open to what he variously called the idiot glee or the idiot energy of rock and roll. Mm-hmm. In other words, think about it, but don't overthink it. Throw everything away. Be open to another Eno phrase, happy accidents, because that's when surprises happen. That's when the magic truly happens. He loved the mistakes, quote unquote, in great rock and roll, in great popular music, the things that didn't sound quite right. Mm-hmm. You know, the mix is bad. The vocals are behind, you know, the drums. Well, that can be an asset.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that would become hip-hop, right?
You know?
Right. So he's always looking forward. His goal with taking Tiger Mountain by strategy, and the British press back in those days was very funny. They were, you know, always looking for some scandal. Eno is a Maoist.
Mm-hmm.
No. Eno had encountered a set of postcards about a Chinese revolutionary Mao-era opera called Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. And then there are various interviews, and he's prone to contradict himself. But I think what he liked was just the mystique. You know, he's a Brit, right?
Mm-hmm.
British imperialism, the mystique of China.
Mm-hmm.
What is China, my China? That's one of the songs on the album. What does it mean in our popular imagination? But also, he said that he liked, quote unquote, the dichotomy between the archaic and the progressive, half taking Tiger Mountain, that middle-aged physical feel of storming a military position, and half by strategy, that very, very 20th century mental concept of a tactical interaction of systems. Okay, Brian. Now, you've always got to couple the theory with this playfulness.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first album on which Eno used the oblique strategies. What is the oblique strategies? He and his artist friend, visual artist friend, Peter Schmidt, came up with a deck of cards, Greg.
Mm-hmm.
Originally 60, later expanded to 100. And the idea was, whenever you were at creative loggerheads in the recording studio, you were to go to the deck of cards and draw one out. Okay, and then follow its advice. This was very open-ended advice. Use an old idea. State the problem in words as clearly as possible. What would your closest friend do? Try faking it. Honor thy error as hidden intention, and so on and so on and so on. I will say I have a purchased from Brian Eno's website deck of the oblique strategies.
Yeah.
I've used it when I couldn't figure out how to motivate one of my classes. I've used it with Vortis, my art punk band.
Yeah.
I've used it when I've been writing my books.
Right.
And, you know, it's just to get you out of the rut and thinking. I was like, well, what the heck? You know, work at a different speed. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
In my case, right now, and it is truly amazing. When we return, we'll talk about some of our favorite tracks from Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, Lemonade Shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
And we're back. This week we're doing a classic album dissection of Brian Eno's Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. Now we're going to talk about some key tracks from the record. Jim, why don't you go first?
So the Oblique Strategies guide this album, and, Eno would use it on all of his own projects and many other productions, which we'll talk about in a bit. But I think the best way to kind of dive into the magic of this album is for us to play some songs. The fans were there from the beginning in the critical world. Robert Christgau loved Eno. He thought this album in particular was just a wonderful joy. Lester Bangs, right?
Mm-hmm.
He wrote endlessly intricate Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy, teeming with so many unheard of inspirations. It's going to be another 10 years before the rest of rock catches up. And the last time I made, Lester wrote, so fulsome with the superlatives, I was reviewing Miles Davis's In a Silent Way.
Yeah, right, wow. Right.
All right. What are we talking about? I'll play a song to start us off. We're talking about everything upside down, inside out, and yet somehow coming together to make brilliant pop or rock music. I think Third Uncle is a great example. You know, the drums are the lead instrument here. There's no two ways about it. We have bassist Brian Turrington taking off from One of These Days by Pink Floyd on Metal with that heavily phased and reverbed and whatever affected bass guitar. We get that on Third Uncle, and then we get these rollicking drums. The drums are the center of the mix. The drums are driving the show. And Eno, in a monotone, is just reciting what seemed to be unconnected lines. It wasn't until later that he began to draw from the Dadaist Hugo Ball, in particular, putting words on balls in a, like, bingo distributor and just taking them out, and those are the lyrics, okay? Here he was just riffing on nonsensical words that somehow do form a story. What is the story? I'm not really sure. He wrote, being a collection of arbitrary sentences, which are full of conflicting and incongruous images.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what are we talking about? There are tins, there was pork, there are legs, there are sharks, there was John, there are cliffs, there was mother, there's a poker, there was you, then there was you, right? And it comes around every time to that killer hook. Here in 74, 2-3 years before punk rock explodes, 5 years before punk becomes new wave, you know, he's laying the groundwork for both. What a trip. Third Uncle, man. The Feelies used to cover it.
Yeah.
Bauhaus covered
many,
it.
Many covers. they did indeed.
Probably Eno's best-known solo song.
Yes, it is indeed a well-known song. Along the same lines, The True Wheel is a track that sort of blends those elements. To me, this whole record is about futurism meeting primitivism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an idea drawn from the early Velvets. You know, the whole idea of high art and low art, where you don't want to go, is the middle brow.
Right.
You know, but you're combining these two incongruous things that should not go together and making something out of it. So the True Wheel is speaks to that. I'm thinking about that sing-songy childlike choir that's in the song, mm-hmm. you know, kind of. It's very, very nursery rhyme-ish almost. And then you've got that Manzanera solo, which is just bonkers. I mean, it's just like nobody's played a solo like that on a rock record up to that point. I don't think so.
Well, Eno was famous for torturing his musicians in a good-natured way. Robert Fripp, later on St. Elmo's Fire on Another Green World, was just told to make the sound of the lightning between the masts on the ship.
Right.
And Eno didn't play him the track.
Right.
And then the solo. And apparently, while Manzanera was recording this solo, Eno was banging on the guitar.
Yeah, right. He would do all these kinds of things to sort of disrupt the normal pattern of thought or how a song should go. There's all this wordplay in the song, and actually the first verse really speaks to the Eno aesthetic, and we are here to let you take advantage of our lack of craft. Certain streets have certain corners. Sooner or later, we'll turn yours.
Yeah.
We're going to show up on your street with this new thing that we've got, right?
We're going to blow your mind. Yeah, did you get into what the phrase, we are the 801, means?
Well, yes. I mean, the first letters of these words, 8 and then 0, naught, and then 1, E-N-O. What does that spell?
Right, right, right.
801 equals Eno. He claims he just made that number up, but Manzanera borrowed it for his project. Manzanera's 801 is named after that song.
Well, yeah, a great live album, and Eno is part of it.
Right, exactly. And, you know, he name checks other bands in the song, A Certain Ratio, future progressive band in the UK, in the Factory label, and a current one. He mentions the Modern Lovers, another band he really, really loved. You know, was a big influence on him.
Because he loved the Velvets.
Childlike and the progressive, right?
Right, right.
So here you go. You combine those two worlds in the True Wheel.
Already we've played two songs, Greg. That was The True Wheel. I played Third Uncle. They couldn't be more different, and yet they're very clearly part of the same project. And then we get to the Fat Lady of Limburg.
Yeah.
Well, I rang up Pantucci, spoke to Lucia, gave them all they needed to know.
Eno said, this is a fantasy about lowlife. The speaker represents an unidentified undercover organization hiring someone for a job. The Fat Lady of Limburg is an expert on something, some unspecified substance. Limburg's a town in Belgium famed for its very large asylum. The inmates may or may not be real. That's what we're paid for. We're just doing a job. We have no feelings about it, said Eno. A Burroughs type song. What does he mean there? You know, from Eno to Kurt Cobain, the cut up method of lyrics. I'm going to take this page from the newspaper. I'm going to snip out different phrases. I'm going to shuffle them, and there are my lyrics. And the meaning will come forward from whatever the heck is going on. You know, this is in some ways a very, very silly song. You know, from the beginning, you know, to me, it ranks up there with Bohemian Rhapsody.
Right.
What was Freddie Mercury singing about?
Right.
You know, Mamma Mia. You know, I rang up Pantucci. I spoke to Lucia. What is he talking about with this weird operatic kind of stuff? There's a candle, a Roman scandal. Okay. But you get this mood. You get the mood from the music. You get this sinister overlay, and the words, although when you look at them mean nothing, really are like the screenplay for a whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a band that Eno influenced heavily, Robert Christgau said of Wire that they would sooner revamp The Fat Lady of Limburg or Some Kind of Love by the Velvets than Let's Dance or Surf and Bird.
Mm.
Again, the roots of an artistic approach to punk being laid by Brian Eno several years before it happens. man, I want to meet the fat lady of Lindbergh. I've been to Belgium. I did not think to go to see the Asylum.
And the kids from the city, finding it pretty, took it home. And there it was sold. It was changing hands for weeks till someone left it by their fire. And it melted to a puddle on the floor.
We could really play every song, Greg, couldn't we, on Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy?
Each song is a jewel. It's a perfect record. You know, I wanted to play Taking Tiger Mountain, ostensibly the title song, right?
Right.
It's the song that ends the record. For many reasons, I wanted to play this song because I think it's one of the most beautiful songs that Eno has ever written.
Yeah.
And performed. And also points ahead to what he would do with those ambient records.
Mm-hmm.
There's a hint of that going on in this song. Also looking back to his days in the choir, he's singing almost like a hymn-like melody over the top.
Mm-hmm.
You've got this lilting, lulling guitar figure, and then you've got the keyboards kind of gliding mm-hmm. along, and you've got this beautiful, almost, it appears it's going to be an instrumental track, and then the vocals come in minutes into it.
Late in the song, yeah.
Exactly, and I think that's the choir that he dubs the Simplistics.
Yeah, yeah.
Whoever they might be, it seems like whoever was in the studio at the time got to sing in the choir.
Well, again, you know, in theory, people who couldn't sing.
Correct,
but
right.
But it's beautiful.
We keep sort of circling around this topic of, you know, the inspiration, this communist Chinese revolutionary opera, Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. Apparently based on a Chinese novel called Tracks in the Snowy Forest. And in this song, he basically tells that story in condensed form in what his lyrics are, the footprints in the snow.
We climb and we climb.
Climbing the mountain. But it's a beautiful song. And, you know, I think he's also sending up the whole idea, like, everybody's going to think this is a concept record, and it's really not. It's just having fun doing this kind of these experiments.
It's interesting because the title track of Here Come the Warm Jets was also proto-ambient, beautiful, mostly instrumental.
Mm-hmm.
And then the title track of Taking Tiger Mountain, the second two of the four pop or rock albums, are 50% ambient each.
Right.
So this is Eno effectively closing the book on being a pure rocker.
Right. I mean, I think you could look at Here Come the Warm Jets as really an extension of Roxy Music more so than this one.
Mm,
this one's more transitional to me.
Yeah.
But whatever, they're all great and they're all different. And it's amazing that he made these four records and then really didn't return to this style of music for a long time. He did the record with Cale and then later with David Byrne. But he's really not made these kind of records again in his career.
I think, and there's a fair amount of ego in Brian Eno. I've interviewed him several times. We interviewed him once on the show together. And when I really pressed him on, it was circa the record with Cale, which had a difficult birth. They were at each other's throats the whole time. And you see it. They're trading daggers on the cover of Wrong Way Up. I really pressed him why he didn't. And he's like, well, I felt like I'd done everything I wanted to do. And I'm like, no, that's your simplistic answer. Why not? I miss you singing. And all of a sudden, Brian Peter George Eno, he was wordless.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, you like the way I sing. And I said, yeah, I really do. You are a great rock and roll singer. He seemed really genuinely surprised by
that. Well, he's not conventional rock and roll singer, though. You know, he's not Paul Rogers
or even Brian Ferry.
Right. But he's got his own sound, and it's very steeped in church music. I mean,
there's a lot of Catholic.
I mean, there's a lot
church
of those
England
melodies
and,
in there, you know? He likes melody. That's the thing that always got me, is that his feel for melody was always very strong. So even if you think, oh, Eno is too much for me, that's too avant-garde, his melodies are there in spades on these records. I mean, yeah. It's just amazing how many melodies there are.
And even the instrumental ambient music.
Yeah.
We reviewed not long ago Andre 3000's ambient flute record, right?
Yeah.
Well, what distinguishes a Brian Eno ambient record from the 99% of new age ambient music are strong melodies. You know, you can hum Thursday afternoon. You can hum discreet music, you know.
Right.
The guy had a flair for melodies. But again, it was his ideas, Greg, I think, that live on. You know, as a producer, the list, you know, is right up there with John Cale.
Oh, yeah.
You know, famously, U2's most creative and most successful albums. Eno told me, too, in an interview, he said, you know, in the first hour that it was on sale, the Joshua Tree sold more than every record I've made in my career. But he said, I look at my work as a strong spice. He's a big fan of Indian cuisine,
right?
You know, this is the spice in the curry that then comes out in everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you two Talking Heads. Mm-hmm. Talking Heads and David Byrne, Coldplay, Laurie Anderson, Slow Dive, James. Mm-hmm. Later on, individual solo stuff, Kevin Shields, Damon Albarn, and we could go on and on and on. People turn to Eno for ideas like Oblique Strategies, for his philosophy of the recording studio, for his ability to, as he would say of you too, basically, I'd come in every couple of weeks and erase anything that sounded too much like you too.
And it was frustrating for these bands. Like, wait a minute, that's what we sound like. And
he demanded that power, I can erase the master tapes, and then he would single out, you know, the Edge making a guitar fart noise that was just him warming up and say, that is where you go.
Right.
Then he'd come back 3 weeks later. You know, for this, he no doubt got paid hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Right.
I want that job.
Right.
Can I have that job?
Yeah. You know, he's not a traditional producer. He's not the guy twisting all the knobs and setting up the recording devices. He is the guy who sits back in the chair and arms folded and listens.
Yeah.
And he gives you, okay, that's not going to work, you know?
Right.
And he'll say, but that little thing you played in the middle there, which you thought was the wrong note, that's actually the right note.
Right.
That's where you need to go with it, you know? And that's what he's so brilliant at. And I think that's really his greatest achievement, is that just telling bands, stop boxing yourself in. And those cards, he still uses those in records. People told me he brought the cards out.
He brought the cards.
Like that he recorded with.
I can't believe you don't have a set. Are you sure you don't?
They're online everywhere. You can get them anywhere you want.
Yeah, but
to
have the physical deck.
Well, I know.
To go to the deck.
But you are like the ultimate Eno fan in the whole world. So, you know.
Yeah, but I know when he's full of crap, you know, and I have challenged him on that. And look, you know, the last couple of years have not been his most productive. He's been rested on his genius
laurels. But I mean, he's made a lot of great records. I mean, did we mention My Life in the Bush of Ghosts? I mean, just the influence of that record alone.
Yeah, that found
the whole art
of
sampling.
Of radio. No, I know. It's
amazing.
True.
Innovations for decades that the guy doesn't need to do anymore. He's already done a lot, you know? He's one of the most innovative people that walked on the planet the last 50 years.
Yeah, but boy, that environmental concept record, the last one, was a real turkey.
Oh, yeah, he's made some bad records. We should definitely note the fact that he's not perfect.
He's made some bad ones.
The catalog is full of duff records, but he keeps cranking them out, you know? Nonetheless, he loves tinkering in the studio. That's his main thing. I remember that when he did do a little bit of a tour around that Cale record in the early 90s, mm-hmm. and I had to interview him. But and he came to the Park West, and
it was just a Q&A.
And he brought, you know, like a CD player, and I think there might have even been a keyboard at some point. But there was no indication at all that he was going to play anything.
No.
I mean, it's kind of, and the audience was like begging him to play something.
Right.
Give us an example. Give us four notes.
Right.
And he refused to do anything.
See, I think that's another chink in the armor.
Yeah.
Because if you go back to the first two Roxy albums, all the videos, they made a lot of TV appearances for those first two albums. You see Eno on stage. You can't take your eyes off him. Brian Ferry's one of the greatest frontmen in the history of rock. And he's so charismatic, right? You've got him as lead vocalist, but you keep looking at the guy in the ostrich feathers. What is he doing? Eno was a great performer.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to me that he's always refused to perform again. You know, for someone who spoke so eloquently about the idiot glee of rock and roll,
right,
that's been a disappointment. So, Brian, if you're listening, and he would, but, you know, he did listen. I don't know if you recall this and had this honor, Greg, circa Wrong Way Up. When Eno thought he was being interviewed by an interviewer that, and again, this is the ego, up to his level, he would take out his tape recorder and tape your conversation, just like we were taping it for the newspaper or the magazine.
Right, right.
And every time I've interviewed him, I had that, I saw him take his tape recorder.
Yeah,
out.
Well, he knew.
But I would tell him, look, Brian, you got to play live, and you got to sing more.
Right.
Come on, get over it.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's disappointing, but I also think it's kind of a been there, done that scenario with him with almost everything he's done.
Well, he said in that Detroit interview, I was tired of touring. It's like, yeah, but just like one concert. Come on, man.
Yeah. He could have been kept on making zillion-dollar records with U2, for example, but he said, well, take this guy Lenoir. He'll do it for me.
And I'll just come in every couple of weeks and hit the erase button.
I don't want to be in the studio with you guys that long. You know, it's just like, man,
it's
you know?
Too much work.
I know. You guys are too much work, yeah.
That wraps up this portion of our classic album dissection of Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. But don't go anywhere. When we come back, we'll play an excerpt from our 2011 interview with the man himself, Brian Eno. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
In the haze of the morning.
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back. We just finished up our dissection of Eno's 1974 album, Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. And we found it appropriate to hear from the creator himself. This is an excerpt from our 2011 interview with Brian Eno. While he didn't speak on this album directly, he did share a lot of thoughts on innovation in music production and creation and the decline of the traditional music industry.
These are your orders. Seems like do it or die. So please read them closely. When you've learned them, be sure that you read them up there, specially flavored.
First of all, I think really we all need to start using a different word for this thing called music, because it's so different from what people were doing up until the beginning of the 20th century, say. If you think about what happened to theatre and cinema, so you had this thing called theatre, and in about the early part of the 20th century, people started filming it and very quickly realised that you could do things with film that were entirely impossible in theatre. And they gave it a new name. They called it cinema, the movies, or something like that. It doesn't mean that theatre has died. It just means that it diverged into two separate art forms. Well, really the same thing happened with music. Music from about 1950s onwards, with the birth of multi-track recording, became something much closer to painting than to traditional performed music, in the sense that people like Phil Spector and George Martin, and later me as well, were saying, okay, a piece of music doesn't have to exist before we start making it in the studio. And it doesn't have to be done on one day.
Yeah.
Well, as soon as you have multi-track recording, you can say, well, let's do those drums today, and then let's put a guitar on next week, and then let's go back to look at those drums again, and we'll change the sound of them, we'll make them a bit brighter, or we'll do this or that. So it's a process much, much closer to painting than to traditional performed music. It's very, very interesting to note that music students had very little impact in this new technology. They didn't really get it. They were still anchored to the idea of performance and of the recording studio as simply a place that kind of transferred something out of the air and onto a record. But we art students thought, oh, this is like painting, but it's painting with sound. Now, as you point out, we're in a slightly different situation, actually a radically different situation, where we don't have to do this in great big soundproofed rooms with complicated microphones and so on. We can do it, as you say, in our bathroom, though my bathroom is very small, so I'd make very small pieces if I were in there.
Be a minimalist record.
Very minimal, yes. The feeling I have now is that the digitization of sound allows us access to sound in really, really strange new ways. As soon as you turn sound into numbers, which is effectively what you do when you digitize it, is you allow it to be subject to all sorts of mathematical operations, which sometimes have nothing to do with our prior experience of sound. So I think we've now gone to a new level of abstraction in music. Well, music has always been a very abstract form. You know, it was a great breakthrough in painting in the early part of the 20th century when suddenly the subject matter could disappear. When Kandinsky walked into his studio one night and saw one of his own pictures turned on its side, he didn't recognize it, but he thought, wow, yeah, what's that?
Yeah.
And he suddenly realized that a picture that didn't have a subject could still be a painting. Well, music has actually always been like that. Music is an abstract form. What I think's now happening with digitization is that it's a new level of abstraction. And we're only just starting to discover what that actually is and what it does to us.
Reactioner for 1 minute.
You're 22 years old. You're coming out of art school. You've called it the idiot energy of rock and roll. There had to be something exciting about being in Roxy Music, standing on stage in front of Phil Manzanera, Brian Ferry, Andy McKay, Paul Thompson on drums. You know, I mean, it's just when you're in a room with a great drummer, you're feeling the bass drum hitting your chest. You don't get that from the digital experience. Is there any charm left to rock and roll happening, you know, in a room, people exploding at the same time?
I know exactly what you mean. Well, of course, this is one of the reasons that I still do like working with bands, because bands still do that. You know, I think the biggest, I'd say, limitation of the new digital life we live is that it puts such a big stress on the individual again, and so you don't get that strange synergy that often happens when you're with other people, where suddenly you find yourself doing something that you wouldn't have thought of. So what often happens when you're working entirely on your own is that you keep sliding down the same slope again and again. You know, this is your habit. But that's very good practice, because when you take those skills that you've acquired sitting in your own studio at night, as I often do, playing around with things, and you then go and work with other people, you find that you've got a whole repertoire of possibilities that you've been storing up, and you are so relieved to be deflected from your normal path,
right.
That you put a huge amount of energy into the working relationship. If you think back to the 18th and 19th century, the huge technological discovery then was the orchestra. Well, I think the great technology of the 20th century in music has been not the orchestra, but the recording studio.
Yeah. Well, it's a weird world we're living in right now, Brian. I mean, I think you've talked about this, where the fact that it is so easy to make a record now, as opposed to 30 years ago, this, in fact, is very empowering. It's democratizing music in a way that's never been before.
Yes.
The question is that a good thing?
Well, I think there are two sides to this. Anyone who grew up in the 60s, as I did, will remember the enormous social power that music had then. It was enormous for two reasons. One was because it was a new medium that was being explored, and suddenly everybody could relate to it in a new way. It was very thrilling that it had broken open, much like, say, cinema did in the 40s, much like novels did at the end of the 19th century. When a new medium appears like that, and everybody knows about it, and everybody's keeping up with it, it becomes a cultural center through which people can connect with each other, can talk to each other. And music certainly did that. And part of the reason it did was because there was a very narrow bottleneck on what was getting released, because there weren't that many record companies, there weren't that many radio stations, certainly in England. And so quite a narrow stream of stuff was coming out, and therefore everybody knew everything that was going on. Now I think we're in quite a different position. What's happened in music is rather like what happened in literature. You know, at the end of the 19th century, everybody knew what Dickens was writing, what Jane Austen had written, and so on. Nowadays, there are thousands of novelists, millions of books, and hundreds of ways of buying them. And so it's impossible to have a scene that is so centered as it once was. Well, that's not bad. It just means we're in a sort of tropics now rather than what we were before. We have a tropical situation where there are thousands of species of music around, and they're all constantly crossbreeding and hybridizing. It's very exciting, but you can't keep up with it easily.
She clutches it.
That wraps up our classic album dissection and return to a little chat with Brian Eno. As always, we want to hear from you. Leave a message on our website, soundopinions.org. Tell us what you thought of taking Tiger Mountain by strategy or anything Eno's done. And if you'd like to hear the full interview with Eno, it's episode 310. You can find it on our website and streaming platforms. Mr. Cott, what is on the show next week? Can we do Brian Eno again? More?
No, but Brian Eno's a buried treasure, and I think he'd appreciate next week's show. We're going to play some tracks flying underneath the mainstream radar that we think everybody needs to hear. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern, who did a lot of that Eno, is Max Hatlam. And our social media consultant is Katie Kahn.